Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Waite, and my guest tonight is the writer Raphael Torch. Raphael's work has appeared in the Indiana Review and the Crab Orchard Review. He has won a fellowship in prose from the Illinois Arts Council and a literary award from the same organization. His work was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. He graduated from Antioch College and received his MA at the University of Chicago. He'll be reading from his manuscript, The Garcia Boy. Hi, Raph. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. How about you start out tonight reading a little bit from your manuscript?
Okay. This is from the first chapter of the book, The Garcia Boy. So here goes. They stopped their car on some dark street somewhere in the 2300 block of South Hamlin. It's almost 2 a.m. and they're stoned and paranoid and out of their minds and tragic, and everyone in the car is now tied together for eternity, whether they like it or not. Two of them, Rolando and Zayil, are in the front seat and their ears ring. They mindlessly watch the gunmen run out into the streets just beyond the shadows that are laid down by the neighboring playground, lightless homes and still barren trees of early spring. The gunman's feet stomp out over the wet concrete, and the light from the street lamp shines and glitters along the streets. His shadow looms large out over the sidewalks and tree lawns of Little Village. They watch him throw the pistol into the street, into the gutter. Rolando and Zayil look around to see if anyone is watching, and they don't know if anyone is, but there are many people watching them. And they sit there in a mournful silence. It overwhelms them. It's like they were sucked through a vacuum of time and space and then spit out because out of nowhere the sound of the neighborhood comes on them, like a burning feeling, rattling down through their nerves, making them tingle. It's in their limbs and in their guts, the noise, and it makes them sick and have a kind of shortness of breath, which is funny because they haven't even run anywhere or done anything that would have caused such a condition, but their hearts are beating like scared little animals. They look into the back seat, and their friend lays slack, his body being back and to the left, lying along the cheap leather seats. They look at each other, and then the next thing they know, they are mindlessly trying to drag their friend from the back seat of the vehicle, but he's heavy and awkward, his limbs spilling everywhere. It sputters and wheezes as innocently as a baby being fed, but as dark as, well, as dark as someone who's just been shot in the chest and in the head by an unknown teenage gunman. They take their hands away when the blood comes from his ears and they stare at it. The kid, their boy. After the noise of train whistles and the hum of traffic from the Stevenson Highway miles away out in the dark, there's quiet again. Like being pushed out of time and moving too fast, there's just a heavy, burdensome quiet they can't define but know because one looks at the other and then they look again at the kid. It's the feeling of deja vu. If you were made to endure déjà vu for eternity. This has happened before. Have we done this, felt this, believed in this before? Have we acted this out in our lives, on this stage? There they are, look, standing over the kid and his blood and guts and everything. There's an electricity in the moment, and the boys know it, and somehow looking up at his friends, the wounded boy knows it, and he thinks it's death. But since he's been shot in the head, he thinks in sporadic moments. And time is jumbled, like if you took a reel of film and spliced it and put the scenes back together pell-mell, and then ran them together with the sound out of sync. He's thinking in another kind of history. He has other kinds of memory. Everything is confused and lost, and yet maybe everything is just perfectly in its right place. He's about as close to heaven or hell as the boys or I am going to get. The kid... the wounded, the shot in the head and chest. The yellow dome light of the car shines down over the seats and across the dash. The doors are wide open, and the boy looks into the back seat. Blood trickles from his mouth. There's blood on the window, bits of muscle and bones splayed out along the leather upholstery. Déjà vu in French means already seen. It's as if they are waiting for someone to come out of the bushes and yell, "Cut!" They want actors and catering and manufactured lights and fake houses, a faulty script. They want production assistants and cameras, manipulated moonlight, a sound lot. They want dry ice to roll over the pavement, music somewhere. It's as if they are waiting for someone to come out of their houses and yell, just joking. They think these boys and strange practical jokes and riddles, and this could be one. And the feeling of wanting to laugh comes over them, but they don't, because you just can't fake the kind of gore that comes, spurts out of the holes in the kid, and soaks into the seats. You just can't joke like that. They know no joke like that. It's not in their lexicon. The way it comes out in a deep purple and then turns almost in slow motion before their eyes, a bright red. Thinking about blood, the power of it, the magic of it, the aura that surrounds it, takes one out of the ordinary. Pondering it, the boys mutter in Spanish and English to themselves, not making much sense. Rolando says, "Holy crap." Zayo looks up and says, "God damn it." He spits and cries a little. He wants to cry really hard, feels like he should, but it's hard to feel anything right now. He wishes he could cry or feel something. He is empty, but he wouldn't say that. If Rolando asked how he felt, Zayo would tell him, "I don't know, you?" They are looking for a connection. They are looking for the other to reconcile the moment, the happening. Yet neither of them can do it for the other, and so the two boys stand there kind of dumb-like, trying to cry, trying to connect, because everything they have ever heard about or seen in these situations calls for tears, calls for common bonds, emotional voids to be filled by something, for better or worse. A loud buzzing noise comes from the car because the boys have left the keys in the ignition and the headlights are on. Two rays of white light spreading across the damp, broken street ahead of them, stating the aura of strangeness and sentimentality that death carries with it to wash over the area. Somewhere a tractor trailer angrily downshifts out on the 55, rumbling towards St. Louis. Just beyond, the heavy concrete buildings to the south, the prison yard of Cook County sprawls out a stone's throw away. Rail yards and vacant boxcars, graffitied and pulverized by trespassing youth and bankrupt derelicts. A handgun is a firearm small enough to be carried and used in one hand. Rolando looks out into the darkness and sees people coming out from their porches, out under the eaves and out from the silence and shadows like phantoms. Looking into the car, leaning his forearm against the top of the Chevy, Zayil says, "Get an ambulance." He says it into the car, to the battered body, remarkably calm. He says in Spanish, "Get an ambulance! Get an ambulance!" Zayo yells, coming to from his stupor, leaning up and standing with both his hands on the roof of the car. To anyone, to the faceless, he yells, implores. He beats on the machine in both English and Spanish, both languages utterly senseless and cruel on the tip of his tongue. The wounded boy gurgles blood from his mouth. His eyes are vacant. His body jerks and hiccups. There's blood on his hands and on his head, on his torso, and the boys don't know how to stop it. They just want to stop the blood. Is that too much to ask? One boy applies pressure but doesn't know where exactly to do it, so he hugs the kid, his friend. He tells the Garcia boy, "It's going to be all right, man." The Garcia boy tells him with blank eyes, like a person who is sleeping with their eyes open and dreaming. He says, "It hurts. This hurts so bad." And then he says nothing, and his eyes float away, that glimmer he had that I once knew when I taught him about Jay Gatsby and J. Alfred Prufrock. His body goes limp like someone deflated him, took the air out of him, the engine hum of him, and his pants go wet in the crotch. Zayil stands free of the car and moves away from the body and the vim and vigor of the death gesture of the fallen, the gurgling, the hiccup, the ooze. The street lamp, the opulent haze of it, frames the kid if one were to photograph him looking up, filming from the legs up. It's cinematic. Spring is coming. A warm breeze kicks through, sweeping up the dust and dirt that hangs on people coming out to greet the dead kid, the dead Mexican, the same old story. Somewhere, out in the distance, stray dogs bark.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Raphael Torch, reading from his manuscript, The Garcia Boy. Raph, I wanted to talk a little bit about the point of view and the narrative voice in your work. You know, when I was reading it, there's this watchfulness in it that seems somewhere between, you know, I was thinking about the eyes on the billboard in Gatsby, that kind of the eyes of God watching. And then it's also kind of like a nosy neighbor. Mm-hmm. And it's in between those two things. And, you know, it's sometimes we're in the we, you know, it's kind of all of us watching, and then it narrows down into the I of you, because mm-hmm. this is a work of creative nonfiction. And then there's a lot of they watching them. And I just, like, where did that come from, and how did you work with it? And if you could just talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the drafts of this were hard to write, in the sense that I had to kind of fictionalize what I thought happened, gathered together by, like, information gathered together by rumors. Mm-hmm. Pilsen and Little Village, you know, where these things kind of happen all of the time. There's lots of rumors all the time about gang shootings, so no one ever knows the truth. And I also feel as if so much of the story is about me as well, sort of. What it's supposed to do is bring us onto this story about the Garcia boy. When I was born, my last name was Garcia. So this idea of death, and that this is how I have to go about finding my identity, or this American story. I don't always feel totally a part of Pilsen, even though that's where I'm from. Hmm. So I wanted the strangeness of being an alien, or like the billboard. I mean, the billboard is just in Gatsby is this. Well, it's a billboard, right? I mean, it's high above us, and it looks at us, and we look at it, but it's not there, right? And there are times when I feel not there, but totally present. So, a few things. I mean, I had to make it mine, the story, and I had to really sort of convey that strangeness that I have, and I think that Mexican Americans have, and one half of this novel is the Mexican-American story. And what does that mean? You know, the straddling of two worlds, not feeling correct in either world, the Mexican or the American, because you are too much of the other for one of the groups to take. And it's violent. I mean, intellectually, it's violent sort of thing to come across. And I think my teenagers are very, the students that I used to teach were very aware of it, but mm-hmm. it was impossible to articulate.
Yeah, it's 'cause what I was thinking is, there's one, just as a writer myself, I was completely jealous, 'cause you kind of worked with this narrative voice that I want to try, but I have no idea how to wield it. Mm. And that's an omniscient narrator, but whose creations, you know, 'cause it would be kind of weird to say characters in your work, because they're actually people as well, mm-hmm. but whose creations don't tell them everything. So it's, omniscience normally means they have access to everything. And it's this sense of a world that is mm-hmm. known, like the details, like the narrative eye knows where to go and knows where to look. But when it sees these things, doesn't always understand how to interpret it. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool. And I'm really jealous, and darn it.
Yeah, there are two boys, like literally. In reality, there are two boys that are with this kid, one of my students, Sergio is his name, and he was, you know, the dilemma was, do I go find these kids and interview them? Mm-hmm. And I struggled with that. Like, people are going to read this, and they are going to think that it's true, because on some level, the book is nonfiction. But it doesn't matter, right? What matters is that this kid died, and two of his friends were there, and they were stoned, and it was 2 a.m., and why were they out at 16 years old on a Saturday night, the three of them, gang members, in Latin King territory, right? It's telling of a kind of, you know, I guess, and again, and even them, they're aliens in a foreign territory, right? So all of this is just sort of feeding into this story. And I don't know enough Spanish. I tried to write in Spanish their words. It feels as if when my teenagers spoke Spanish, they did it out of nervousness. Uh-huh. So they immediately go back to their first tongue. I really wanted the violence to be there. Violence is violence is violence, right? Someone gets shot, they bleed. And I think the people that I worked with after the killing, they wanted to sort of romanticize it. Like, there was no blood. there was no gore. There wasn't this kid in the backseat of some beat-up car, right? It was, they still wanted to make, it was the A student. And I'm like, no, that's, when people die, it's ugly. And I think that that's a very real part of the community. And in a lot of Mexican-American, I don't want to totally be oversimplifying this situation, but in a lot of Mexican-American stories that I've read, there's a romanticism of the neighborhood that they come from, which is fine, and I enjoy that. But where is the other stories? You know, the
tougher ones,
the tough story. You know, and
yeah, the ones, the stories that write against that romance.
Mm-hmm. Who's the author? Did Always Running? I think he's
Luis Rodriguez.
Right, I mean, yeah. He does those kinds of stories. But I wanted to write it from my point of view, this, you know, coming back to the neighborhood,
right.
Being raised in a white sort of middle class milieu for, you know, and so this is how it came out.
Great.
Yeah.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Ellen Wadey. This is Prosody, and our writer this evening is Rafael Torch, reading from his manuscript, The Garcia Boy. So there's another side to your family. And yeah. I'm wondering if you would read a little bit from that history.
Sure. This is my, just to introduce it, my great-grandfather on the Torch side, so my mother's grandfather, his name was Francesco Torchia. He came through Ellis Island in 1917 and slowly headed west. And so this is his, this is an introduction to his life in the coal mines. I think he saw a sign that said, "Go west, work." It was in the 7 most well-known languages of the world, and he sought out the Italian in the sign and went to the office that interviewed men. And he went there, and they told him he would need to have a physical, and he tried to explain to them that he'd already had one. I'm healthy," he told them. Too many physicals in a short time, and he was going crazy from no money and no home and no family or friends. Where was the prosperity and the life he had imagined? But he relented, and they gave him a thorough checkup before they put him up for a few days so they could gather other ethnics and strange slanted-eyed people who would all cram themselves up on a train and ride 3 days out over the great bumbling and belligerent yet wholly beautiful Appalachian Mountains. They need stonemasons and miners, men to go down into the earth and gorge out of the mighty rocks bituminous coal, and other men to cut and stylize marble with their hands from their intellects and imaginations, columns for buildings, buildings themselves, huge sweeping places that would all at once institutionalize and tame the West, these rolling foothilled valleys in the great green American nowhere. Where he was headed was to the bottom of a mine and into the soot and the burning center of the world, and given dynamite to blow it out into hell and to be covered in the ashes of minerals used to light the homes and set the fires that would steam the country forward. To Grafton, a little town on the Fairmont coal seam, a seam that stretched from the northern Appalachians down into Georgia. Grafton, a small town about 40 miles south of Pennsylvania in the Ohio River. He'd go on down there in the dark with the mules and the men like ghosts with black faces and black hands and heavy arms and legs, pulling, gouging, manipulating the underbelly of America, fueling her industry. It's so dark down there you can only see their eyes, and when they smile, their teeth. They smile quite often, joking and mustering enough muscle to ratchet out a few rocks of the pure stuff, the black gold. They think of themselves as a noble group of men, the ones who have done it, picking up where their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers have left off in tiny hovels called tunnels. They have dynamite. Tunnel mules never see the daylight. They're like a whole new strain of animal born and birthed and raised up in the dark and in between the shadows of fading candlelight. These dusted relics of men down there cramped and burning alive, rolling west. Frank looking out the window and in tatters or near it, and when they finally get off in Morgantown, West Virginia, he's like a ghost with great black circles under his eyes and haggard limbs, numb and senseless. He gets off the train and they are lined up and various company men are standing in front of them and everyone speaks a different language. And he listens for the Italian, but some of the English becomes clearer to him, like stop or listen up, or line up, or what is your name? Frank Torch, Frank Torch, Frank Torch. With each new time he ratchets it out, the name, he becomes it, and slowly he thinks that this is his name, the family name. Frank Torch, line up. Frank Torch, go over here. Frank Torch, you're a coal miner now and company man, and Frank Torch, you will move into a home with 10 other single men. And the plaster in your house on the walls will be cracked, broken, and in many places loose, and the clapboards are cracked or missing. The floors sag where you live, Frank Torch, and they are rotting and moist, and sometimes you make squish-squish when you walk on them after it rains, but never mind all that, Frank Torch. You're a company man now, boy. The company will take care of you. Buck up, buckaroo, old Frank Torch. The roof may need mending, but you have no money. But we'll give you money if you go down in them pits and crack, crack, crack away at the stone walls of the earth. And mind your business, and don't voice any opinion or try to be a tricky guy or something funny, Frank Torch. Don't be a nobody but you, Frank Torch. To fix that roof, it costs money, and you ain't got no money, and neither do the 10 guys you live with, either, and you know it. Let the rain come. Sometimes it will fall hard, and other times not. Maybe just a drizzle here or drizzle there. Who cares? Frank Torch, never mind the deep bone chill you have. That'll go away. Never mind it. Wake up, walk to mine, go into mine, work, get ahead, fix your roof. Your house serves a purpose. You will eat there and sleep there and then work. Repeat. Don't be nobody's special or nobody's hero. Just be Frank Torch. And he thinks that this is his name even as he hears it and answers to it. And he's trying real hard to be that guy in the denim overalls and white t-shirt and flannel jacket with a helmet on and dirty face and thick hands like anvils, the way they hang so heavy at the side of his body. But being and believing are two different things, and he's having a doozy of a time trying to put the two together. But most of the time he can't, so what's in front of his face from the darkness? Can't see 10 feet in front of himself, let alone articulate some god-awful jerk in the pit of his stomach that's trying to tell him stuff is wrong, or odd, or what have you. Coal. The atomic number for carbon is 6, and 6 is a perfect number if you didn't know. And Frank, when he came to Grafton, worked hard and lived Spartan, eating when and whatever he could. Eat he did, live Spartan, working like a dog. And the town, Grafton, was filled with quickly built homes with rough boards and bottom sides built on wooden frames above cellars where people kept family goods. Sometimes the cellars below rough-hewn homes were simple dugouts, and the homes themselves on pillars, weak pillars bitten and gnawed on by mites and whatever bug it is that eats wood. What's its name? How do you say? If anyone drew a bad lot, sulfur streams burned and rumbled down under the house, and in times of storm it would flow under your house, and you have to live with the stink, the streams of sulfur. Under your home the streams may flow. And there are explosions out of nowhere, these streams pushing smoke. It's all highly flammable. The vileness out of the earth, the welter and the waste of the beginning here under your house, and God is sending you a message. What it isn't entirely clear. There's an energy that's been stored for millions and millions of years, and you're the recipient of its meanness, all that vileness packed under the earth. You are the recipient. And the streams are antediluvian and biblical, simply burning, and at night the burning water can be seen in the night by its pale blue flame visible from anywhere, always the stench, the sulfur in the air, in the lungs, on the lips, in the food eaten. The pale blue flame, the beginning and the end. And God saw the light, that it was good. And Frank says nothing to the men in the quarry. He speaks only to other Italians, and they ask him, "Where do you come from?" And he tells them, "From Calabria." The other Italians nod as if to say, "Yes, I know where that is." The men nod yes, those that know where it is. Frank says to them, "Where are you from?" And they tell him, "We are from Sicily," nods all around. Everyone knows about Sicily, and the Irishmen tell them, "Shut your yaps and get back to work or else." The Italians have heavy looks that they wear, scowls and strange brown eyes that penetrate deep, their eyes do. The Irishmen are always crazy and always into the dark first, because they are lower than the niggers, some of the men say, the Germans, the Slavs, all of them say it, and if everyone says something is true, then it must be. Frank hears them and believes them because he isn't a hero. He knows that word, nigger. The Irishmen fight hard, and kaboom! There goes the dynamite that tears off the rock from the sides of the earth, and it all crumbles to the ground, the rock that comes from the side of the earth. I can't hear anything. My ears ring. The first time is the worst, and I stumble around, and my head, oh, my head and ears, they ring. Where are you from? What? They ask Frank. Where are you from? And he tells them, I am from Italy. I am Italian. I am from Calabria. I am from a little town. This is where he is from. And after a while, little by little, the questions chip away at him, and he starts to doubt himself until he has nothing but answers. But the kind of answers devoid of any meaning and reality. What is Italian about him, Frank Torch, company man, coal miner, watch out, soon to be Marxist? Other than his skin and his voice and the language he dreams in, but only faintly now, for he hears in his dreams the traces of English. The mystical in his mind takes on the hard, stupid wrenching of English and the vowels and consonants. In his dreams, the foreign are chasing him down in their dirty overalls and black faces and screaming at him in English, barking orders, and he's got nowhere to go. And the next thing he knows, he is awake, a sweating beast of a kind of man, and he is alone, and there is no way for a man to live. His answers to questions posed to him about his being or essence become problematic. I can hear the hard trace of English on his lips, the way it bends them and makes them heavy. His thick Italian tongue awash in English. It's not him. All of them start to mind themselves a social life built on American phrases they pick up. They begin to build relics of themselves, of broken promises and hopes and ideals, and they share them in the brawling English they pick up here and there. Inspect warily in the dark they do this new language. The strange thing they've wrestled from the earth, jewels and gems, the criminal elements of language. Hello, how are you? What is your name? I am of Italy. I am coal miner. I live over there in house with broken roof. I know not what you say. Your mother is whore. I hate you. I love you. I cannot understand what you say. You speak slowly for me, yes? I know, stupid. I hear good, yes? You know yell to me. I Italian. I kill you. This unfair. I am human being. Brawling, the language Frank Torch learns is, needs to be for him. He wrestles it and minds it and looks at it in a kind of light only he knows. Faced with the strange, crippling phrases and redneck words that are raped and pillaged, these American English words. I get it, and you speak loud too much and fast like bullet, and it is hurt my ears. Kaboom goes dynamite, dogs go bark bark, cats say meow meow, boss says, get back to work, you lazy son of whore. Son of whore? What is son of whore? I know son of whore. Everyone just shrugs.
You've been listening to the prose of Raphael Torch reading from his manuscript, The Garcia Boy. Thanks for coming to Prosody, Raph.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Joseph Wilk, with special thanks this week to Daryl Jones and Electric Mayhem Studios in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.